Did you hear that Pikachu talks in the latest Pokemon movie?
Yeah, I didn't watch the clip though. I don't want to see that.
It's fucking weird.
Yeah, not into that.
I hope he has like a high voice. If he's like, "Hey, Ash."
But there was that Detective Pikachu thing where he had a super deep voice, but that never came out.
Doesn't Pikachu talk in some kind of like Sherlock Holmes thing?
That's what I was just thinking.
Sherlock Holmes, yeah, but this is
called
the
Detective Pikachu. I don't think it ever came out, though.
Is that that he speaks with a voice in that, or that he's just got lines on screen? Or has he always had lines on screen?
No, he speaks with a voice.
But this is an actual, canon episode movie, so he does actually have a weird voice saying like, "Ash, the only reason why I didn't go in my ball is because I love you too much," or some bullshit like that.
Who cares about Pokemon canon? Hello and welcome to Keyframes, a podcast about anime. I'm your host, Ben Halliburton, and with me today are Andy.
Hi.
Duncan.
Hello.
Jeff.
Yellow.
And John.
Hi.
Now, I know that you're going to be surprised by this, but we have a lot of people who are really enjoying Land of the Lustrous, so I think we're going to launch into a big old love fest that involves 3/5 of the podcast. Possibly Andy. I don't know what you watch, Andy.
I've been very busy this week between watching it and another anime film, so I haven't had any time to watch anything. I'm all ready for when I watch it and we talk about it next time. So,
well, John, as our Land of the Lustrous proselytizer, do you want to start or do you want to go in with one of the newbies like Jeff? What do you think about it, Jeff?
Yeah, let Jeff go first so I can tell him when he's wrong.
So I started watching it about a week ago. I didn't really know what to expect. I heard it was Gem Girls, and I had seen some noise on Twitter about how Foss is the best girl, which is true.
Well,
and
they're not girls. They have no gender.
We're off to a good start. Yeah.
Female presenting. Geological formations.
It's interesting you say that because I thought they were female presenting too, but then I read an article, which I think it's from a woman's perspective, who says they present masculine. So, perspective, I guess.
The latest episode sort of undercut that.
Yeah.
Well, do you want to describe what happened in the latest episode then, or do you want to do the premise first?
They all put on dresses, to cut a long story short.
So
big, frilly dresses.
Men can wear dresses.
Okay. That is true. True.
And there is also one extremely masculine presenting character who is very obviously the center of attention of all of the other female presenting characters, which leads me to think that while they do pointedly like degender everybody when they refer to one another, because the concept of gender doesn't really have a meaning for these people, because as if it's not obvious, because if you haven't seen it, they're all made of minerals, like they are rock people. I think John has already gone over this in the past.
Yes, there's guys from the moon that want to break them. That's all I remember from.
Yeah.
So they're like orcs. Aren't orcs made from rocks?
No.
What?
No. 40K is banned on Warhammer 40,000.
It's not even like they're a fungus in 40K. So like,
oh, I was thinking of Lord of the Rings. Aren't they like born from?
I was
rocks?
Thinking of like trolls. I think. Oh,
yeah,
anything.
Trolls.
But no, the Lord of the Rings orcs are like.
They're made of elves.
Yeah.
They're twisted elves. Actually, Tolkien's cosmology varies a lot because somewhat charmingly, his Catholic sensibility was offended at the idea that something could be like made fundamentally evil. And so he really tried to like work to revise the orcs as not twisted good people. Anyway, that's your Tolkien nerd aside.
Yeah.
Can I just ask real quickly? So like, is the gender thing just Chrome then, or does it actually have a role in the plot or the characterization?
Nope, they just don't have a gender.
So
okay, that's all.
Yeah, what the show really is about, in you know what I get out of it, is that everyone in the show is immortal. Everyone, and everybody on in this colony of 30 some odd gem people all have a purpose in life, except for the main character Foss, who is struggling to find her footing. And a lot of the show is around her trying to find herself, or them trying to find themselves in a society who have, for the most part, written them off, and them, you know, realizing what is important in their lives and trying to work towards that and trying to grow as a person. And also there's other beings in this world who are, it's hinted at that everybody on the show is descended from humans, but they're all very much post-human.
It's not really hinted at so much as explicitly stated as part of a myth, though, like past-time stories.
I love how anime uses like myth to just like fill out backstory a lot of the time. Like, there's this myth that happens to be the exact thing that actually happened.
But it also, I mean, it's sort of like that. But it's said by a person who is a liar.
But the true that
you don't get the impression that she's lying there. By the way, I think that she's explicitly female because she talks about how they breed.
Yes.
Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. There are undersea people who are gendered and have a completely different life cycle, who have been subjugated by the moon people, who are also possibly post-human and are not physical beings, and they're drawn to the gems specifically because they want to regain their
humanity.
Yeah, they want to bind the three trailing remnants of humanity back together, and that's sort of their motivation.
But they're the bad guys for wanting to do that?
Yeah, I mean, sort of. The myth is the legend, whatever. The story is passed down. All of those things apply, I guess. The humans kind of separated in terms of flesh, bone, and soul. And gems are the bone, flesh are the sea people, and sea souls people. Are the moon people. It's not necessarily, like, you know, they're not literally the bones of humans, but like that's sort of the representation, I guess.
It's an allegory.
Yeah. That's the word. Thanks.
No problem.
This is why you're here.
Yeah. It's also notable that the undersea people are not immortal. They actually have a life cycle. They actually do breathe.
Yeah, they have a life cycle. Yeah. And it's unclear if the Lunarians do, the moon people, the Lunarians, whatever.
It sounded like you had something to say a little while ago, Duncan, really quick about the myth.
Yeah, it's just that in the beginning of the second episode, you get what's almost like an animated, almost like a cart. It's halfway between a cartouche and a tapestry almost, which shows the sort of history. And it's narrated by the John and Jeff. Would you say that Congo presents as male, or is he also a they?
I don't know. He might just be a human. I don't know.
Yeah,
they never refer to him.
Is he like? Is he just billed as the narrator, or does he have a body or personhood in the?
Because it's like he seems like it's a he, but he also refers to them as a collective us, and so I wonder if he's like just another class of gem entirely or something. But who knows?
Well, in the myth, they talk about somebody who made a deal with somebody else, and it's never really quite clear, that led to the creation of the gems. And him or them being the leader and like a father figure to the group implies that perhaps, you know, he is responsible for them. And there's also the show is 3D, like it's 3D animated, and it kind of gets around the problem with everybody looking like a doll, because everybody is literally, you know, a rock, and so them moving a little bit stiff is not such a big deal. And they also sell that with a definite sound of like stone hitting stone when they move around, which is also something that happens with the monk character whose name I can't remember now, goddammit.
Congo.
yeah,
but also like when you see the king Ventritokus?
That's a difficult name.
Those are some sounds that I heard someone that don't even sound.
Hang on,
like
I have
anything.
It written down. Do I have it? Shit, I don't. Life is hard. Ventricotus. I think that's right. Anyway, she is explicitly fleshy because she's a flesh being, you know, the whole whatever. She's very jiggly in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels a lot more fluid than gems, and it still looks okay, but it's probably because she's like a weird octopus lady instead of a supposed to be looking like a human.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, she kind of looks like a jello.
Yeah, there's like a specific problem with like actual humans with especially long hair that really tends to make a 3D animation, at least at this point in development, choke up or look really bad. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. Like I'm just thinking of Griffith's hair in the Berserk movies is just like an animator's nightmare.
Yeah.
But John was definitely right before that because of the character designs, the limitations of 3D don't really hurt it and almost help sell the look and feel of the world.
Hmm. It's quite strange because they don't technically have skin. They just have a powdered white surface mm-hmm. on top of their gem. And so it's the weird thing is, why are they choosing to do this?
Yeah, because it definitely seems aesthetic to them.
Yeah. And so is it because Kongo is there and he's their reference for how someone should look? And because he has this white skin, they decide, well, I don't want to just be this multifaceted colored gem. I have to have skin like he has too.
I think there's some evidence to the theory that he's not human, because when they all go into the ocean, he explicitly does not. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't get covered with the protective stuff to, you know, save their powdered cover, whatever. Mm-hmm. So I think, like, you might be right, like, they are trying to emulate him a little bit.
And Fos does say when she's preparing to go, like, the reason everybody's going to the ocean, Fos has been talked into taking King, the big mollusk lady, into the ocean, and she is slathering herself in like a resin to protect her skin. Because she specifically says, if I don't do this, I'll end up looking hideous. So there's a weird sort of like self-loathing when it comes to what they really are. And I don't know if that is a specific commentary or anything, because they haven't really gone into that. Yeah. But
I think she also talks about corrosion to the salt and stuff.
Salt water, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I think it's specifically the skin powder that would corrode and not.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, the other thing is, like, you see one of the all the gems have different, is it moles? Is that the hardness scale?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Moles. Sure. One of the tougher ones is, there's an early scene where I think it's Jade is punching Kongo and her arm just breaks. So whatever he is, he's harder than most of the gems. So he's probably not human either, but what exactly he is what the Lunarians want to make them into? Who knows? Because he has dreams of being almost courted by them.
Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's so far the show has done a really good job of creating an intriguing world. Excited to see where it goes. The latest cliffhanger was was pretty good. They're doing a weird thing with Fos, because during she gallivants into the ocean, encounters the mollusk people, and you know it's a big trap being set by the Lunarians, and she loses her legs and she gets an upgrade, and now they are seeming to want to push her further into losing more bits.
So the thing with
Wait,
that is,
what's the update?
Huh?
What's the upgrade that she gets? She just gets better legs.
I'm getting to it. Oh, right. The thing about losing parts of themselves is that, like, their memories are not stored in a central place, like our brain, mm-hmm. for example. Like, so if they lose their, let's just say one finger, they're going to lose a very tiny bit of memories, probably. But if they lose it and, like, all of their legs, like, that's almost a third of their memory just gone. And they make a point of emphasizing that. They can replace the legs with, like, other gems, and they do that with some pieces of a shell of a giant mollusk, which has turned into agate, I think it was. Mm-hmm. A quartz agate, something or other. And they like, replace her legs, and she learns how to use them, and then it's, like, a really huge upgrade for her because it's more durable than what she previously had.
Does that mean she gets that mollusk's memories, then?
That's something I'm curious about, because mm-hmm. there's a point before that where she gets, like, basically digested and dissolved by a giant slug. And, like, when they reform her, she has the ability to understand the slug who just it doesn't, the details don't matter. She gains a new
ability.
Saying that makes it sound dumb, but it's not. she's like, sorry.
Oh no, I was just gonna say, because this is the way that you guys have described it has been about how it's like about Foss's personal growth, but is there also like more of a traditional anime power arc to it? Is she like getting stronger or making friends or anything?
She's getting stronger, but she's like losing parts of herself as a result.
Yeah. That's interesting.
That's what makes it good.
It's like what kills you makes you stronger.
They can't die, but sort of. Yeah, like every time she experiences a trauma and then she becomes out stronger. In the first episode, she's looking for Cinnabar, who is an alienated gem person, because she extrudes a poisonous sort of, or they
I do it too all the time.
I mean, the fundamental thing is it's got some traditional action tropes, but it's got a very well constructed world. Like there's the one of the gems Cinnabar sort of secretes.
Mercury.
I think it's arsenic.
It's mercury.
Mercury, that's it. Sorry, and it poisons everything around her. And one of the little things they use in the first episode to establish that is that you see that the landscape she patrols, she's just left this path through all the grass, where it's just dead and brown. And so they do some quite good ambient world building instead of just, oh, this, she secretes this terrible poisonous stuff. It's subtler than that. I think the thing we have to admit is probably if Foss wasn't as likable as she was, it probably wouldn't carry itself as well.
Yeah, yeah. The characterization of Foss is really good.
I mean, that's true of any story, though. Like, if the main character sucks, you're gonna hate the show.
Yeah.
as evidenced by our perennial favorite to hate Black Clover.
Oh, fuck that.
But like, we can talk about the world all we want, but I think what makes it really strong is, I mean, I guess what Duncan was just saying. Like, Foss is a really good character. It's hard to tell that she's the youngest. They're the youngest gem at 300 years old. 300 sounds like a long time to us, but to them, it's like, I think the oldest gem is 3,597, if I'm remembering.
Something like that.
Yeah, something like that.
That's Yellow Diamond, and like they're a new character in the past two episodes, I think. It doesn't matter. So Foss being the youngest, even though they're so old, is, I think it's rubbing on her because they don't feel like they're useful, which I think Jeff brought up earlier. And you can you can tell that they're very like sad and melancholic with the world. Like they want to be more, but they don't know how to be more. And like that comes through a lot, I think, through the, like, not just through what they say and what they do, but also through the framing of like, basically the direction is really damn good in this show. Like they do an excellent job of framing scenes in such a way that it sets the tone and the mood, and it looks so good at the same time. They take advantage of colors in a way that, man, it's really good. I don't know. These are things that I'm not good at talking about, but it just, I notice it in a good way, and that's unusual for me. And
I mean, it sounds like it has an unusual weight to it for being like, there are two Land of Illustresses for me, and the one is the thing I see online and in GIFs of just like cute pale gem girls like stumbling around and like just having kind of usual stuff. And then when I hear you guys talk about the plot and this incredibly intensive world building, I wonder, like, that's kind of the holy grail, is just like cute girls or girl presenting gems and like really, I don't know, the world sounds very vivid and very unique and different, not only in terms of art style but in terms of presentation of writing and the like, and I mean, and that's very intriguing.
And yeah, technically it's just a world, like visually or sorry, setting wise is like, I think it's like an island or maybe just a beach with some rolling grass fields, so it's not like particularly interesting environment, but they make it interesting with the framing and the colors and all the stuff I was saying earlier. Yeah, it's great. Love it. Yeah.
Cool.
And cool. In terms of like the difference between how it looks and what it's trying to say, I'd say that there is actually a pretty close parallel to Nier Automata. Video game came out this year, directed by Yoko Taro, which has, you know, a lot to say about the existential dread of living a meaningless life in a post-human world. Mm. And also, look at these good butts. Both of which this show does very much.
Yeah,
and
that was a good butt that was just posted earlier on our Slack. So,
yeah, I think somebody trying to argue that the female presenting gems are actually male presenting. I would need to read that article to really see where they're coming from, because hopefully it's not subtle.
Hopefully John remembers where it is and I can put it in the show notes, because I'm also curious to read it.
I think they just kind of mention it offhand, just like all these masculine gym people, blah blah blah. We just don't go into detail with it.
I mean, that's like I wouldn't expect a Japanese anime to get very into that, but the whole like dynamic of butch and femme, and in recent years the diaspora of genderqueer and non-binary presentations means that there are more and more opportunities for one person to see a figure, especially a drawn figure that's not a real character, and be like, oh, that's a woman, obviously. And then someone else seeing the exact same thing under the exact same circumstances would be like, no, that's obviously a man or a male presenting woman. Or,
and I think it just has a lot to do with perspective. Like, I'm a guy, so I'm going to see things that stand out to me that are not like me, I guess. And like, I'm male presenting. I don't make any qualms about that, I guess. Whereas somebody who happens to present female is probably going to notice things that are the opposite of what I'm noticing, and I think that's probably just why.
And there's also a wide range in how the gems are characterized. Like, there are some who behave very feminine, there are some who behave more masculine, and everything in between.
And they all kind of have identical body types too, but then the hair is what sets them apart, kind of.
Yeah.
And like, when, you know, they got colors to their eyes, and when they open their mouth, you can see the gems inside. And which, by the way, I think it's pretty cool. I like that.
Well, I've been racking my brain for a transition to something else, and the best I can get is going into a brief rant about My Girlfriend is Show Bitch from talking about butts and good butts, or actually the opposite of good butts. I don't know. Like, I don't want to make like a torrent of negativity, especially about a female character, a regular feature on this podcast, but like, besides Ideon, which I'm currently watching, Space Runaway Ideon, this is pretty much one of the things I'm watching. It's just, I feel it's important to explain how sometimes anime fail. And, I mean, Show Bitch is not a good anime.
Yeah, but I mean, with Show Bitch, it's not just her, so I think you're fine. It's everything. Yeah. The whole anime is terrible. Well, so you're not like, you're not shitting on one character in particular, you're just shitting on everything because it's a terrible show and I don't know why you're still watching it.
That's like, the question I have.
It's directed badly, it's shot badly, the animation's terrible, the audio, the VA quality is terrible.
You're like, eating my lunch, Andy. I mean, the interesting thing is,
I'm just saving you from trying to look like you're just shitting on one person when you're not. You're shitting on everything. Yeah.
Well, the thing is, like, it's so funny that so many anime that are one male character who's the protagonist nominally, and then a bunch of female characters just have a bad male protagonist, that it kind of is a non-issue, as opposed to Show Bitch, where they're all bad and just bad in different ways. Because like, to go back to the beginning, like, this, every episode of Show Bitch is living proof that like, confidence is the most important ingredient in a sex comedy, and that compassion for its characters is the second most important, and Show Bitch has neither. Every joke is ruined by what an incredible, like, cringing, desperate hurry the anime is to like, tell you the joke so that you don't make the joke to yourself first and ruin it for them. And that makes all the characters look like extremely like idiot perverts, but especially, I mean, like it's really telling that they introduce a gay character in the most recent episode, a gay male character. And usually, I mean, I think honestly, he's written in your typical like really bad gay stereotype in anime, like Liron from Gurren Lagann, who is just incredibly lascivious and aggressive. But the fact is, every character is already like that, so he just seems like a normal guy who happens to be gay. It's just these hitting on the women as opposed to the women hitting on the men. And I don't know.
Wait, did you just say the gay character is hitting on the women?
The gay character's hitting on the men instead of the women hitting on the men. It's just he might as well. He's no different except for his presented gender and how he behaves, because all the women are already really sexually aggressive and kind of tin-eared. And I mean, it was really weird because last episode there were a couple of actually really good jokes, and they were jokes that had nothing to do with sex, and it just makes me think that these people don't know how to do sex comedy. They had like a joke where they had like a bit of a fight, and the girl was like, oh, I'm going to be the most devoted girlfriend ever, and she was just following him around, like giving him everything before he needed it. And like everyone in the hall started looking at them like really creeped out. They're like, God, he's so abusive. He's like making her do everything for him. She's opening doors for him and like getting him his pencil and stuff. And so like, and he just had to be like, I'm not abusive. She wants to do this. And they're like, uh-huh. And that was funny. And then they were talking about, as an offshoot of that, they're talking about like the perfect meal to like make for him. And they all just like suggested really wholesome stuff, and he started to do like the Tsukomi, like, don't get all sexual. Oh, wait. And then they were all weirded out. They're like, why would it be sexual? We're talking about your favorite meal. Why wouldn't you want tonkatsu? See, you're kind of laughing. It's kind of funny. But the whole show, the rest of the show is just... The show is funny when they're real people, and they're usually not real people. They're usually these, like, seething hotbeds of, like, lust and anxiety. How we assume our teenage years are in hindsight, but aren't actually that way. I don't know. Showbitch is bad.
Yeah,
don't be like me. Don't watch Showbitch.
I mean, by comparison, like, I also watched a couple of episodes last season of Hajimete no Gal, which was fucking terrible. Well, it wasn't terrible.
Okay.
When the female characters were talking to each other, that was enjoyable. But it was shot through this disgusting male gaze of this one guy and his friends. One who is like a massive lolicon and doesn't want any other girl above like 8, and he says that literally, and it's fucking disgusting. And you're just like, every time they come on screen, I hate their existence and everything about this show. And then when they leave, and it's admittedly this guy being a fucking pervert, and which is fine for that age, like he's gonna be a massive horn dog who by force asked to go out with a gal who he finds scary, and she says yes. Like, the gal is actually quite cute and sweet, and then like there's a bit of sweet romance interactions, but it's like so much of it is so hard to enjoy that it just wasn't worth me watching the rest of it, so we dropped it after like 2 episodes because it was But then I can stop watching things.
It reminds me of how we talked about last episode, how we talked about how part of why Akine-chan is terrible. Part of why Akine-chan is terrible is because of transphobic bullshit. But part of why she's terrible is because the show seems to hate her. Mm-hmm. And a lot of Showbitch doesn't seem to think that any of its characters are like worthwhile people. Not the like sex-obsessed virgin, and not the like transfer student Ojo-san who makes bestiality jokes all the time, and she's like just really likes her dogs, but she just always talks about playing with them using the wrong language. And yeah, it's all of these are funny on paper, but it's just they don't like the characters and they don't trust the characters to carry through the joke, and so they make the characters tell the joke, and then they do circumstances that like shit all over the characters for being so perverted. And you're supposed to laugh at both, but you really, in practice, as a human brain, you can only laugh at one, because either you think what they've said are funny, or you think these people are stupid and gross. And I don't know. Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like you should just watch Oshiete Gaoko-chan or rewatch it if you've already watched it, because it sounds
I was wondering. Good. Yeah, well, I mean, whatever. I'm unemployed. I've got the time. But, like, did anyone watch Surizure? What was it? What was the thing
Surizure
last?
Surizure Children, right?
That was good. Oh, that was, like, good sex and date comedy, wasn't that?
Yeah, that was a date. Like, they all were, there was, like, what, 12 couples or something? 6 couples? I can't remember. But, yeah, that was
Agami
also, like,
SS,
half the
but good.
Length as well.
Speaking of shows that are bad, like Showbitch. Let's talk about Ancient Magus's Bride.
Whoa, okay.
Well, it's not bad. It's
pretty bad.
Wait a minute. What? Hold on a second. No, first of all.
No, only Jeff. Only John's allowed to be negative. You can't be negative too, Jeff. It.
This is bullshit.
Okay, I've seen exactly one episode, the first episode.
I'll fight you. Anyway.
Yeah, but did you see that like amazing platter of British food?
Oh, yeah. That was the best part.
Oh, God.
It totally was.
I'm going to kill myself.
What were you going to say, John?
Yeah, so, hey, Angel Magus's Bride is fucking perfect.
Yep, great.
You can't see my face on the podcast because that's bad radio, but...
okay, so everybody here, it's no secret to anybody that knows me and talks about anime with me that I love Angel Magus's Bride, the anime, or sorry, the manga.
Mm-hmm.
And the anime.
I was really excited for the anime. And, like, it's frustrating how adequate it is. Like, it's not good. It's just there, and it succeeds in copying the manga onto the screen, and that's about it. And it's really frustrating, and I'm disappointed with it, and I want it to be better, because I like the manga so much, and
How would you like it to be better? Because I'm watching it. I haven't read the manga, and I find it pretty good. The
animation sucks
behind.
Half the time.
No, it doesn't. It's pretty good.
Yeah, it fucking does, dude.
Like, the episode I just watched was the end of the cat episode, and there was some good animation in that. Some lovely, petals and shit. And
the cat episode was so, like, amateurish in its, like...
Don't. I think you're...
The pacing is all off in the show. It just feels like it loses all of the impact of everything.
But I think that's because you've read the manga. So you've read it at your own
pace.
Yes,
but, like, that doesn't matter. I read My Hero Academia, and I fucking love that anime. I read a lot of manga before I watch anime, and that's not why I just think the manga is infinitely superior, and the anime is... Bleh.
So... Just a specific example of something that, in your view, they rendered wrong.
The
something
cat
which
thing.
They
all of it.
Okay, so which?
Like what?
Just help us out here. Like, what? For those of us who have neither read the manga nor seen the anime, what was good in the manga version and what was bad in the anime version?
I can't remember.
So the cat arc is that they go to a city which is full of cats. And it seems that magically the cats are controlling the city and they have complete control over it. But there is an evil presence in this island on the river where there is an evil presence. And Chisei, I'm bullshitting names, sorry, Chisei has to go in and dispel the evil presence so that the cats can and the cat tribe can live happily. She goes and does it, gets into a bit of kerfuffle with some other evil dudes who probably will come back later, pretense, and then...
Did you watch the latest episode?
No, I haven't watched the latest episode. I'm a couple of episodes behind. I literally just finished that episode today.
Okay, gotcha.
So, and then, you know, the cat queen came in and was about to sacrifice herself for the evil presence that was sitting there, who just wanted to go home, or to move on, and she was going to go there, and then something happened with the fairy lady, which I didn't quite get, and they all went off, and then there was some nice animation in a blue field, and then they all fucked off, and then that was the end of the episode. And it was sweet. It was nice. It was like...
See, the way you just described it is pretty much how I feel. This happened.
But they did some... I don't know. I felt they hit some like touching points. She made a speech about how she... wasn't a slave, even though the evil people viewed her as a slave. And there's some nice stuff about how, you know, evil isn't inherently evil, that it was begat from sort of like other circumstances. The other people were trying to be evil to protect her from who they believed is a bad presence and a bad influence on her. Like, there are all these things that are in play, and I think it's pretty good. I think it's pretty interesting. There's a lot, I mean, I can't comment on the manga because I ain't read it, but I can comment on the anime, and I think it's pretty good. I also think the animation ain't bad, apart from they don't open that guy's mouth, which is a bit weird. But
fucking animation.
Okay, so I've only seen the first episode, and it left me with a really bad taste in my mouth. Mostly
you're wrong.
Okay, so
I know what you're gonna say, but go on. Sorry.
Okay, so maybe this is something that goes away in time, but the whole relationship between Chisei and the titular Ancient Magus has this really creepy, paternalistic
Yep, vibe, that's not which, how it is.
Okay, so is that something that the anime gets wrong, or is that something improves?
No, it's fully intentional, I believe, that it presents it that way at the start, but it very quickly moves away from the oh, I bought you to be my bride thing. The point is, and I think I talked about this last time I talked about Agent Magus' Bride on this podcast, is that Elias does not know what the fuck it means to be human, and so he's making mistakes, and he's trying to learn through Chisei, and Chisei is trying to be more happy with herself through him, and that's the relationship that they have, even if it doesn't present that way from the get-go. Like,
okay,
it's
I'll give it a few more.
It flowers, you know, like into something more, or blossoms into something more than what it seems like it is, and I assume that's intentional. And it works for me. As more and more information is revealed, and like there's stuff to come, like that hasn't shown up in the anime yet, that's way down the line that will, you know, progress that even further and further and further.
I agree. I think like Elias's whole thing is that he's very childlike and doesn't really know what he's doing in order to help her become like the powerful magus that she could potentially be. But he's doing it by hook or by crook, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So I agree with that. But it is weird at the beginning. I also agree with that.
Anyway, to go back to what my problem is, I can't cite specifics, but it just feels like the show lacks a lot of the emotion that it should have, and that's where it loses the impact for me. Like, sure, the events are still interesting and good, but I don't know. It just doesn't make me feel, I guess.
If I were to say that Ancient Magus Bride was made by a fairly young studio, Wit Studio, that was largely put together to make Attack on Titan, although they also made Convoy of the Iron Fortress and Rolling Girls, would that maybe give you an insight into like they just aren't experienced enough? The director, this is his first full-length thing to direct besides a Yawapeta movie, so...
I mean, Attack on Titan is a very, very good adaptation. Like, you like it or not, like it does what the manga does, but better.
Again, I don't know about that. I think it does at the beginning, but then it slows down to a crawl at about halfway.
Have you read the
there.
Manga? It's infinitely slower, dude.
I read the manga before the anime. Like, I know what you're saying, but I also think that the anime did do a thing where it did like a chapter an episode, and it could just be that there's not much happens in a chapter, but I don't know, I felt it got pretty slow at points.
I'd go into this with you, but we don't got the time. I'll just briefly mention, Covenary of the Iron Fortress is an original project, which is hilariously exactly like Attack on Titan, but with zombies instead of Titans. Also, it's pretty all right. It's fun to watch, kind of like Attack on Titan. Rolling Girls, we all dislike...
I just wonder if it's harder, it's kind of harder to make an adaptation sometimes than an original work, because like you said, pacing is really hard, and it's hard to oftentimes convert a manga, which you can take as much time as you want on any panel. Hopefully you aren't taking like a really long time on every panel, otherwise it's going to be slow going for you, but to an anime. And it reminds me a lot of how Zack Snyder supposedly like directed the Watchmen adaptation, where he used like the speed up and slow down thing to like make things that lasted a long time in the comic last a long time in the movie. And it's just, it feels like it's a hard thing because our brains are really great directors of narrative. And so when we are presented with a manga, it's really easy to like have the perfectly directed version that would actually be really hard to achieve in an audiovisual medium. So I wonder, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean,
there's good adaptations and bad adaptations of anime, of manga and anime. So
yeah, and like you said, they're like, I guess they're young or whatever, and that could be it. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I do understand what you mean by emotionless, though. I didn't get much emotion than say Three Lion, which has a lot of emotion and does it very well. But we're not talking about emotion.
Man, I love March Comes In Like a Lion. I wish it could go on forever. We don't even need to talk about it, but like,
no, it's the best chess anime that I've ever seen.
It's, I say it every time, but it's everything that I wanted from Honey and Clover with none of the infantilizing, literally infantilizing bullshit of Honey and Clover. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
talking about Shaft, can I move nice. On to my thing?
Yeah, no, yeah, by yeah, all yeah, means. Yeah. You earned that segue, so go for it.
I watched on Wednesday a film that's been named over here, titled over here Fireworks, but the full title is Fireworks. Should we see it from the side or from the bottom? Or the bottom, which is a Shaft-directed film that came out, again, in the cinemas in England, which I just want to say is pretty cool. England, I guess since Your Name, has had a bit of a renaissance in anime, and I've seen loads of anime films in the cinema, which I mean is fucking cool. If you're in the UK, I know that Lou Over the Wall, which I talked about last week, is going to be in cinemas on the 6th of December, I think. So if you're listening and you're in the UK, go watch it, because it's cool to support anime in England, and also it's a beautiful, it will look great on a big screen, and it will, and I will probably go watch it again, because I think I have an incorrect opinion about that movie. And it deserves a rewatch.
Explain that.
Okay, that's weird. No, I'm just going to go ahead and tie that into something. Andy, you hate Shaft, and you hate Akiyuki Shinbo. So
I think you just got that because
I've got that from the times you told me, I hate Shaft.
I just do it to wind you up, because I wrote that thing on Slack, being like, pretentious name by a pretentious director, and I just thought that you'd be really upset, and then I was like, oh, I might have gotten a bit too far. I don't hate Shaft. I love a bit of Shaft. Feline's good, Monogatari's good. I just do it to wind you up, babe. That's all. Because
it works. He's one of my top three directors. So Akiyuki Shinbo, Mizushima and Hideki Anno are my top three, and they're all great. Garbage.
I'm sorry. What? I know. I just those low hanging fruits. I just got to pick them.
Well, these aren't low hanging. These are high hanging fire flowers.
Oh boy.
Yeah. So anyway, the director I found out isn't even Shinbo. He's the assistant director. The main director is a guy called Takeuchi Nobuyuki, who I haven't actually checked out what his stuff is.
Oh, you know who has checked it out? It's your host, Ben John Halliburton.
What did I do? Huh?
No, he's a keyframe artist. He's been a keyframe artist at Shaft. He's also done keyframes on almost every Miyazaki Ghibli movie. And he was also animation director and key animation for Utena and the Utena movie. So he's he's been on the art side for a long ass time.
Mm.
Oh, he also did art on a Penguin Drum. We should do Penguin Drum someday when we actually start doing 20 odd episode animes, because Penguin Drum's just such a hot mess. Anyway.
Yeah. I mean, that would make sense, because the story of Fireworks isn't much to talk about. There's a guy called Shimada, and then there's Norimichi, and then there's a girl called Nazuna, and there is going to be a fireworks festival on the last day of school. Then they have a swimming race, and she decides, whilst that swimming race has happened, that whoever wins the swimming race, she will ask to go to the fireworks. Then when that person goes to the fireworks, she asks them to run away with them. I would say it like that, because then what happens is a Groundhog Day thing where the guy throws a giant, a marble that he has, and then it throws and spins. He makes a wish, and then it reverses back in time. And then instead of his friend winning, he wins the race so that he goes out with her. I say that there's not much to write home about plot-wise, because there really isn't. It's not an exciting or interesting plot, apart from the time reversal thing, but I feel that we've seen that better in other stuff like ReZero and Tatami Galaxy, for example, just off the top of my head. But what it does have is it has that emotion of young love that I really enjoyed, that first kiss, that sort of them meeting in that perfect romantic spot, that romantic date that they've always dreamed of having. Because basically what happens is she wants to run away from home because her mum is going to remarry and they're going to move. And she wants to enjoy basically the last day of this like odd town in by the seaside. And yeah, it's a fine film. It's not like the best film I've seen this year. But it's an enjoyable film. And it would make sense that it's not done by a keyframe director, because the animation, art's good.
Yeah,
the art's pretty good. Like the whole reason why it's about fireworks is because they have a long conversation about whether, and the main thrust for the male protagonists, there are a bunch of male friends, their protagonists are like, they were wondering whether fireworks explode, are they round or are they flat? And they go and try and find out. And also, like, I mean, you look at the writing isn't even the same as, like, it's not to the level of Monogatari, because it's not like a light novel type author. It has
no, this
a very
is this is a first script by the guy who did the script for it. So yeah, it's not a writing focused thing.
No, but I mean, in its defense, the writing feels very natural. It feels very like normal kids talking about stuff. Mm. So I enjoyed that, which is good because you hear a couple of the conversations a few times, and then it sort of ends on this weird like bittersweet thing as like a firework explodes and everybody gets flashbacks of what could have been. And that's kind of sweet. Like I said, it's a fun movie. I'd say if it's in your cinema, go watch it. And yeah, I it was good. Good stuff.
That's good.
But not the best.
I like Shaft doing sentimental stuff because so much of Shaft now is Akiyuki Shinbo's style. And he's, as you pointed out, he's like chief director on everything, where he just puts a rubber stamp on what other people are doing. But he's like, the studio style is so caught up in the artificiality and using title cards and imitating other mediums make you aware that this isn't real and that this is a presented thing. But I think that if you take those powers, those superpowers, and use them to like just make a really beautiful, like nostalgic high school thing, I'd be into that. I'm curious about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting what you say about, like, the Shaft, because, like, the main girl does just look like... I forgot her name, the main character in Bakemonogatari?
Shinjo Gahara.
Shinjo Gahara, and then the main guy also just looks like a potato-kun, one of the potato-kuns. Like, and...
Translator's note, potato-kun means generic male protagonist in an anime.
and then... Also... The animation for a movie like wasn't really that great. Like there was a large scene where Nazuna is singing on a train, and then she sings a song, and then it transitions into a well-known, because Mids, I watched it with Mids and she knew the song, a well-known old idol song. And then it transitions, you know, like she sees a reflection of herself, but dressed up as a princess in the window, and then she presses it, and then it like does like a big like wide scape where it goes dark to white, and then like dark colors to white colors, and then transforms into her being the princess. And like that's cool, but then like everything was CG-ish, and it kind of like the animation was a bit like, it felt for a movie the budget would have been a bit higher for the animation, and it wasn't. It was very strange. The animation when it was hand drawn wasn't bad. It just didn't feel like there was a lot of it. If that makes sense.
I'm looking at the other cast. It looks like the person who created the concept is Iwai Shunji, who you'll know from last year where you saw The Case of Hannah and Alice. He did everything for that. So it's from that guy.
I mean, The Case of Hannah and Alice was a lot better. That was really like, that would make sense. I really enjoyed The Case of Hannah and Alice. I thought that was good. So yeah, go watch that instead.
Alrighty.
Well, do we want to take a break and do a pitch then, or do we have some people who have last minute observations?
I got nothing.
Nope. Yeah, I'm good. Nothing. Cool. Okay. Well, let's take a break and then pitch to Duncan our anime spotlights for the next episode.
Hey, Duncan and Andy.
Yeah.
I was at my local supermarket a couple days ago, and in the ethnic food section, they have a Tesco's section. And
I came back at the right time.
What in the hell is fruity brown sauce?
Oh, don't say those words together.
I just read an article about brown sauce. It's what we would call steak sauce, apparently.
Okay, fruity, so it's brown, like, sauce. Yeah, fruity. Yeah, Tesco brand fruity brown sauce.
That's a disgusting phrase.
Is it like H1 or HP or?
I imagine it's sort of like a Worcestershire sauce. That's what I imagine it will come up as. Duncan?
I don't like
Duncan
it.
Left.
As he should when you hear that phrase.
And we're back. For the second half of our podcast, we're going to be talking about our spotlight animes that we're pitching to Duncan. I think that Andy volunteered to go first, so take it away, Andy.
Yep. Hey, so on Friday, there was a very important for me Blu-ray release, which is available both on Amazon Prime as well as on the Amazon Video service, for In the Corner of This World. The film that I tried to pitch about three episodes ago, and then I realized I couldn't because no one could watch it.
Much longer than three episodes ago, Andy. It was back in August.
Oh, fuck. Well, you can now watch it, so let's go watch it. I really love this movie, and I've been thinking about it for a long time since I've watched it, and I just want to watch it again. I think there's a lot for everyone here to enjoy. There's the historical day-to-day stuff, which I find fascinating, and I found very interesting to learn how how people lived in Japan who weren't in the army in World War. I don't know if that's a very documented thing. I don't know if any of you know anything about it. I certainly didn't, but then again, I don't know anything.
I mean, the advantage your pitch has, Andy, is that I've also read another work by the author whose manga this was adapted from. So,
yeah.
That's your advantage.
It is. And synopsis, it's basically there's a girl who lives in Hiroshima in World War II, and it's the account of her life through that war. Now, it sounds like this is a very heavy, depressing topic. It actually wasn't a depressing film at all. It actually ended in a very uplifting, like, life is good, people is good, but not in the way that you would get in anime of, like, everyone believing in the same thing, because it's a real life thing about a pretty horrific set of events.
So it's not Grave of the Fireflies, where everyone comes out of watching it just shattered, broken people.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not that. It's beautiful. Like, the animation is beautiful, which I think you'll like. There's a lot of very nicely done stuff where through the course of her life, she stuff happens to her, and then it does this beautiful visual effect of how it changes her life and how she views the world, and it's incredible. And then you've got the interactions, the love interests that sort of come in and out of her life. You've got then some sort of like this very odd like fantasy-esque element. And then on top of that, you've got the studio Mapper, who backed it on a Kickstarter, which I didn't even realize. And this was, I think, one of their first things that they've done, or their first major thing that they've done.
Okay.
I could be wrong in seeing that, because I'm seeing that they've done a bunch of stuff. Oh, they did Punchline, but whatever. They've done a bunch of stuff, it seems like. I might have been totally wrong on that. But they're a good studio, and I think that there's a lot to enjoy in there. It's a very good, very, very good anime, and I absolutely adore it, and I want to see it again, and I think you will all enjoy it and take something out of it that that would benefit everyone, and it will make an interesting record. And it's really popular right now. It got nominated in the Oscars something, so, you know,
That good. Old Oscar something something.
It got submitted for nomination.
Yeah. So yes, we should watch this anime.
Okay, well, you said that you were not going to do something heavy, and I am going to do something very heavy, but also is an extreme blind spot, I think, in everyone else's anime background. I am talking about Haibane Renmei, that largely shares, it's based on a comic by Abe Yoshitoshi, creator of Serial Experiments Lane, and it involves most of the production crew from that. It is a short anime, only 13 episodes, about a young girl who wakes up in a mysterious kind of like grayscale-ish world with a halo and wings, surrounded by other people, and she has no memories of how she got there or what this place is. And she gradually makes friends with the other people that are sharing the house in this kind of bizarre, silent, colorless world. And it's an anime about accepting yourself and accepting others and forgiveness and healing. And it is exceptionally beautiful, especially for 2002. And it is really unique and there's nothing like it. And it is really, yeah, great cast, great staff. I can't recommend it enough.
So when watched it. When did you watch it then? Was it roughly when it first came out, or recently?
And pathetically, I wasn't watching anime when it came out in 2002. I believe I watched it four and a half years ago on the device of a friend, my same friend, Katie, a different Katie than the Katie who's always writing in, who is big into Utena. This was also almost on par with her extreme love of Revolutionary Girl Utena. And yes, I think it's great. I think it's strange and sad in a similar way to Lane, but while Lane is often kind of a cyberpunk mindfuck, this is more just about people and things and just like personal relationships a lot more, while Lane is very alienating, as I'm sure John can attest, having watched it recently.
One of those shows which at the time had a very strong reputation, but people don't seem to talk about it anymore.
Largely it's because it was a banner Gineon release, and then Gineon folded a few years later, and so it was just very rare. And also I think it's slightly pre-internet. If you search for Haibane Renmei, like on image search, most of what you get is fan art. There's just not a lot of pictures of it. So it's from that era. Yeah. I don't know. I didn't like it as much as I thought I would when I first watched it, but I think I also didn't know what it was really about. And I'd like to come back to it again, knowing it all the way through, because it is kind of a mystery of like, what are the mechanics of this world, and who are the Haibane, these girls with halos and dirty gray wings, as opposed to the white wings we'd expect from angels, and what's going on with them. And you can kind of just guess from knowing stories told by humankind throughout history, but it's a very nice reveal, and I think it's a companion piece almost to Lane and to Nia Under Seven, which I talked about so long ago.
Okay.
Jeff next.
Okay, so last week we talked about the sort of the first wave of anime that came to North America, and how it was kind of a mix of well-regarded things that did well, and also hot garbage that is completely baffling and terrible. And what I want to pitch is sort of a combination of both of those things.
Oh no!
I want to watch Fist of the North Star, the movie directed by Toyo Ishida. Who also directed Vampire Hunter D and nothing else that I recognize. It looks like it did fairly well over there and came over here. It's a distillation of 50 some odd episodes of the anime.
Is this new Fist of the North Star, just to check?
No, this is 1986 asked Fist of the North Star. It is available on DVD. The first time I saw it was before I'd seen the series. I have seen the first 100 or so episodes of Fist of the North Star, and it is a trip. its impact on other anime that you have seen will be very obvious. There is a Fist of the North Star reference made in Abanabashi that goes by as quickly as you'd notice it. So its shadow looms long over anime in general, and I think it might be fun to go back and watch this one.
So okay, so just double checking, the Fist of the North Star movie in 1986.
Yes.
Okay. Good.
There's a DVD release. It is possible to track it down.
Yeah, Discotech has it now, and their company is exclusively devoted to like digging up old stuff that no one would publish and publishing it, which I don't know how that works as a business model, but they're doing it. So it's also available for streaming on Crunchyroll. Also, Haibane Renmei is on Crunchyroll and Funimation, and it's also the first episode's available on YouTube if you just want to like look at it. If you liked my pitch, just look at it.
Yeah, the movie's in the US only.
We'll mail it to you. It's all good. Don't worry about it. But yeah, that's cool. My pitch. Fist of the North Star.
Cool. John, you want to knock us out?
I just finished playing Doki Doki Literature Club, so I've got literature clubs on the mind. And to that end, I want to watch Hyoka, which is about an apathetic dude who is coerced into joining a literature club. And then he solves mysteries with the help of his aggressive pal, Chitanda. And then they all have a good time. That's what I want to watch.
That is 22 episodes.
It is? Fuck me.
Yes. No, I mean, sure.
I don't care. I'm still recommending it.
Okay, so...
Stop me.
Tell me a bit more of this. What?
Me and Mids have a constant joke about that anime where the English dub's going to be terrible with the "I'm curious" line that Hyoka always says.
It's available for streaming on Funimation, by the way.
Yes, it's there's a $40 Blu-ray as well. If you,
I believe it's two $40 Blu-rays because they sold it in two parts.
Son of a ruining my life. Whatever.
Listen. Kill Annie, man. It's they can make the big bank.
That's true.
Certainly can.
Oh yeah, part one. Listen, I'm not going back on this. I want to watch Hyoka.
We don't
just watch it on your own. No. Well, can you go ahead and like pitch the content? Like, is it comedy or drama or
it's a little
spooky?
Bit of both. The main dude. Oh, fuck. What's his name? Oreki? Oreki. So he's very apathetic. He just doesn't want to do anything. He wants to laze about all day without a care in the world. He's coerced into joining the literature club by, I think, his older sister. And in this club is also a girl named Chitanda. Chitanda. That's right. And she loves mysteries, and she loves to get excited about mysteries and solve mysteries. And Oreki happens to be very good at solving mysteries. And so she's always pestering him to do stuff. And so, you know, against his will.
Sounds a bit like a knockoff Harumi.
Yeah, Haruhi. Melancholy of Haruhi-chan.
Haruhi.
Haruhi Suzumiya, not Melancholy of Haruhi-chan, which is very funny.
Yeah, but there's no supernatural shit in this. It's just normal people.
So is it kind of Haruhi played straight then? A little bit?
I don't know, man.
It's like, Hyoka is called Hyoka because the book club is called Hyoka. And then the main thrust of the first half of the show is why.
Yeah, why is it called Hyoka?
Hyoka, which is actually quite an interesting. That was quite a satisfying conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like Littlest Detectives. I mean,
we just watched part one, in fact.
Come?
I think it ends pretty well on the first core, so we might just be able to watch that.
Yeah, I'm happy to watch that. Like,
mm-hmm. Okay, that's fine.
It's good.
But yeah, I mean, solving mysteries, but it's not like murders or anything. It's just like inane bullshit that Chitana
wants to know
about.
Who stole my book?
Yeah. Like,
I mean, you're not far off.
Yeah, you're not. And it's charming and it's fun. There are also two other characters that, you know, they exist too.
Yeah.
Two other characters that don't merit mention.
No, they're good. I just, you know.
And also, I can't remember where the location is shot, but I've been there. And Hyoka is plastered all over that little village. It's amazing. There's a map where
it's a fictional high school based on a real high school.
And a real city as well. Like a real mountain village. And so, yeah, they've got like, it's cool. I went at the cafe, took some pictures there. They have signed stuff from KyoAni all over it because...
And it is one of my favorite shows of all time. And hey, that's me.
It's good. Pretty.
All right. Duncan, you got a decision to make.
I do. There's two things which I'm sort of aware of, the previous works by either the director or the author, sort of some sense of. There's one which is sort of looms large in the anime canon, which I've never seen at all. And there's one which I have absolutely no idea about and have never heard of previously. I think I'm going to go with Fist of the North Star.
Yeah! Oh.
Because it's like such a big name, yet I have absolutely no idea what is entailed in that. I know it's like foundational, I don't fight anime, but I have absolutely no idea more than that. It's like all I have seen of it is parodies.
I mean, it's kind of what you'd expect if the parodies were just played straight, is honestly what I've felt from it. But it'll be fun to come back. I mean, like, I watched the new Fist of the North Star, which is a kind of OVA spinoffs thing that was made in the mid-2000s, I think. And, like, even then, like, with the value of hindsight, they were still just, like, it's still just, like, this guy just, like, punches people and they blow up.
It's like one of the early films we did was the Berserk remakes, and it's like they were I sort of thinking back to that, wish we'd done the original instead of the remakes, and this is a chance to go do like go to the source and
technically and, still not doing the originals, which are like the 100 odd anime episodes.
We're getting closer.
Yeah, the one thing about Fist of the North Star is the further people get from the original series, the more serious it takes itself. This is one step removed, so it's still very much, you know, this is a serious thing about serious people, but it's still pretty goofy, and I'll be really interested to see if you have any idea what it's about after you have seen the movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's very early. The earlier stuff is like very clearly an anime made by someone who's really impressed by Mad Max. Yeah. And kind of just wanted to make Mad Max, but instead of cars, it's punching. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, it's fun, it's goofy, it's lightweight. I think it'll be an enjoyable watch. And it's relatively short.
We'll have another Dallas.
Dallas was none of those things.
Dallas was freaking goofy. What are you talking about?
Yeah. Come on, there was a
dog. It was not intentionally goofy.
A guy ate a dog after killing it with a robot arm. Okay, well, I know that we don't have any questions, so I'm just going to go ahead and run through our social media presence. Follow us on Twitter at KeyframesPod. Email us questions at keyframespodcast@gmail.com or message us on Facebook, KeyframesPodcast. What am I forgetting? Oh, yeah, just look us up on iTunes, rate, review, and subscribe to us. And tell a friend. Oh, also, podcaster? Pod.
Oh my God.
Pause.
Pod flipper. Up. It's dead. Pod, you're dead. I'm dead. We're all
pod,
dead. Oh my, well, she dead.
Pod chaser. Yeah, find us on pod chaser.
Got it in one.
Yeah.
Pod cruncher?
Pod chaser sounds like it could be a futuristic movie of some sort, like a dystopian sci-fi.
I was briefly considering what you guys were just helping me decide between was this or Bubblegum Crisis, because I thought that would net Duncan some interest too, because he loved Dirty
Pairs. I think
Paris.
It would have still lost Fist of the North Star, but what, yeah. I know John also had a second choice. What was that?
Flowers of Evil.
That would have won.
Oh, shit! No, I fucked up.
Okay, say goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Shut up, Andy. Stop it.
Bye-bee.
Oh, please, for the love of God, stop doing this to
me. Bye-bee. 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 Bye-bee.